Next, I call Guy on the mobile and tell him I won't be back this afternoon. I have an urgent appointment with Conkers.
Conkers?
It's a leisure group I'm thinking of investing heavily in. Need to check out the consumer angle. When I get home, the kids are so startled to see me, they don't react at first. I tell Paula to take the rest of the day off, and I get Emily and Ben into their coats, and we walk to the park. Or at least Em and I do. Ben refuses to walk anywhere, preferring to run until he falls over. It's been an Indian summer, and the leaves, still green and stippled with apricot, look mildly surprised to find themselves on the ground. I honestly don't know how long we spend kicking around in them. Ben likes rushing into the leaves just for the rustle, for the pleasure of the noise. Emily loves to tell him off, while clearly finding him adorable. The deal between my girl and boy is that he can be naughty so she can enjoy being good. Watching them screech after each other, I wonder if that isn't a variation on the game that boys and girls have always played. Farther along the path, under the horse chestnuts, we find the Conkers. Some of the spiky cases have split on impact, and we prize the glowing nuts from their pithy hollow. "You can make the Conkers harder," I say to Em.
"How?"
"I don't know exactly. We'll have to ask Daddy."
Damn, didn't mean to mention him.
Emily looks up in bright expectation.
"Mummy, when will Daddy come back to live in our house?"
"Daddy,"
chirps Ben.
"Daddy."
Back home, I put the boy down for his nap and let Em choose a video while I start to prepare a bolognese sauce for dinner. I can't find the garlic press, and where is the grater? I suggest watching Sleeping Beauty, which was always the great sedative when Em was little, but I am way out of date. My daughter is talking about something with a warrior princess I have never heard of.
"What's warrior, Mum?"
"A warrior is a brave fighter."
"Do you know what Harry Potter's about?"
"No, I don't."
"Harry Potter's about braveness and loveness."
"That sounds good. Have you decided what we're watching?"
"Mary Poppins."
"Again?"
"Oh, please, Mum."
When I was Emily's age, we saw a film or two a year, one at Christmas, one in the long summer holiday. For my children, the moving image will be the main vehicle of their memories.
"She's a suffragette."
"Who?"
"Jane and Michael's mummy is a suffragette."
I'd forgotten that Mrs. Banks was a suffragette. It's not the bit of the film you remember. I go over and curl up on the sofa with Em. And there she is on screen, the lovely Daffy Glynis Johns, back from a rally and marching up and down the Great White House singing, "Our daughters' daughters will adore us, and they'll sing in grateful chorus. Well done, well done, well done, Sister Suffragette."
"What's a suffragette?"
I knew that was coming. "Suffragettes were special women, Em, who 100 years ago went out and marched in London and protested and tied themselves to railings so they could persuade people that women should be allowed to vote." She nods and sinks back onto me, nestling her head in under my breasts. It's only when Mary and Bert and the kids have jumped into the chalk picture on the pavement that she says,
"Why didn't women be allowed to vote, Mum?"
Oh, where is the fairy godmother of explanations when you need her? Because back then, in the olden days, women and men were... Well, girls stayed at home, and it was thought that they were less important than boys. My daughter gives me a look of furious astonishment.
"That's silly."
"Yes, I know, love, but the suffragettes had to show people it was silly." We lie there together. Em knows every song. She even breathes when the actors breathe. Now that I'm watching as an adult, Mary Poppins looks different. I had forgotten that Mrs. Banks, who wants to make the world a better place for women, is dizzily oblivious to her own children. That Jane and Michael are sad and rebellious until the nanny shows up and brings both consistency and excitement into their lives. Mr. Banks, meanwhile, works too hard. His name alone tells you that this man is his job, and is a stranger to his children and his wife,
until he gets sacked and is confronted in his own drawing room by Bert the chimney sweep, who warns him in song, "You've got to grind, grind, grind at that grindstone, though childhood slips like sand through a sieve, and all too soon they've up and grown, and then they've flown, and it's too late for you to give. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down." Emily and I join in, our voices twining round each other in a silvery helix. Suddenly, I have the most disturbing feeling that the film is talking to me, which is when Emily announces,
"When I have babies, Mummy, I'm going to look after them myself till they're an adult. No nannies."
Has she made me watch Mary Poppins so she can say that? Is it her way of telling me? I search her face, but there is no sign of calculation. She doesn't appear to be watching for a reaction.
Ma!
The baby monitor crackles into life. Ben must be waking up. Before I go upstairs, I sit Em on my knee. "I thought you and I could go on a special outing together. Would you like that?" She wrinkles her nose the way Momo does when she's excited.
"Where?"
"The Egg Pie Snake Building."
"Where?"
"The Egg Pie Snake Building. Do you remember that's what you called the Empire State Building?"
"I didn't."
"Yes, you did, love."
"Mummy,"
says Emily, dragging out my title with maximum scorn.
"That's a baby way of talking. I'm not a baby anymore."
"No, darling, you're not." It goes so quickly, doesn't it? One day they're saying all those funny little things you promise yourself you'll write down and never do, and then they're talking like some streetwise kid, or, even worse, they're talking just like you. I will my children to grow up quicker, and I mourn every minute I have missed of their infancy. After I have fed them and bathed them and dried their hair and read Owl Babies and gone to fetch her a glass of water, I finally go downstairs and sit by myself in the dark and think of all the irretrievable time. To Deborah Richardson, from Kate Reddy. This afternoon was spent in illicit mummy time, the most profitable few hours of the financial year to date. How much per hour do you think I can bill clients for kicking leaves and watching Mary Poppins? Sneaking time with the kids feels like what an affair must feel like. The same lies to get away for the tryst, the same burst of fulfillment, and, of course, the guilt. Think I have forgotten how to waste time, and I need the kids to remind me how to do it. Don't hate me if I stop work, will you? I know we said how we all need to keep going to prove it can be done. It's just that I used to think maybe my job was killing me, and now I'm scared I died and didn't notice. Our daughters' daughters will adore us, and they'll sing in grateful chorus, "Well done, well done, well done, Sister Suffragette." All my love, Kay. Kisses. Chapter 38. The Waterfall. 7:54 a.m. As I wait for the knock at the door, I realize how much I have been looking forward to telling Winston about the plan. Finally, here is something I can impress Pegasus with. Proof that I am not just some blinkered lackey of the capitalist system. But after I've blurted out all the stuff about Dad's nappy and Alice's interview with Bunce, Winston doesn't say anything except a curt,
"You gotta remember you got two babies to feed."
5 minutes later, when we're stuck in our usual jam, he asks me if I know the story of Scipio. I shake my head.
"Okay, so this Roman general, Scipio, he had a dream, and in it he found a village which was built right next to this big waterfall. The sound from the waterfall was so bad you had to shout to make yourself heard. 'How do you live with that sound all day?' Scipio asked the head of the village over the roaring of this water. 'What sound?' the puzzled guy said."
Pegasus shudders forward a couple of inches, and when Winston hits the brake, there is a sound like a cow dying. "And the moral of the story, please, sir?" In the mirror I see his grin, sly and full of relish.
"Well, it's like I think we all of us have this background noise, and we're so used to it we can't hear it. But if you move far enough away, you can hear again, and you think, Jesus, that waterfall was making one hell of a racket. How'd I live with that noise?
Are you saying I have a waterfall, Winston?
He lets out that deep, grainy laugh that I love.
Kate, girl, you got Niagara fucking Falls.
Do you mind if I ask you a personal question, Winston? As he shakes his head, the cab is filled with that gold dust once more. Am I your main client?
You the only one.
I see. And how many drivers does Pegasus Cars have? Let me guess. You the only one?
Yeah. Gonna finish cabin soon, though. Got my exams to do.
Mechanical engineering?
Philosophy.
So you're by way of being my chauffeur, my very own winged horse. He honks the horn in joyous acknowledgement that this is so. Did you know that chauffeurs are tax-deductible and childcare isn't, Winston? Another honk on the horn startles a group of suits on the pavement. They scatter like pigeons.
It's a crazy fucking world out there, man.
No, it's a crazy fucking man's world out there. Have you got change? As I'm walking away from the cab, I'm just thinking how much I'm going to miss him when I hear a voice shout after me.
Hey, you need a getaway car, lady?
10:08 a.m. A call from reception. They say there's a man called Abelhammer waiting for me downstairs, and my heart actually tries to punch a hole through my chest wall. When I get downstairs, he is standing there with a large grin and two pairs of ice skates. I'm shaking my head as I move across the floor towards him. No, I can't skate.
Yeah, but I can. Enough for both of us.
Absolutely not. Later, when we are making our fourth circuit of the rink, Jack says,
All you have to do is lean on me, Kate. Is that so hard?
Yes, it's hard.
Jesus, woman. If you just lean on me here, remember you're John Donne. Think of us as a pair of compasses. I'm holding still, and you're sweeping around me, okay? You're not going to fall. I've got you. Just let go.
So I just let go. We skated for an hour, and I'm not sure what we wrote on the ice. You'd have to be a bird, one of my pigeons, or sitting high up in my boss's office to see what we wrote that day. Love, or goodbye, or both. He wanted to buy me a hot chocolate, but I said I had to go. The smile never faltered.
Must be an important date.
Very. A man I used to know. Surprising how quickly you can forget how to hold someone, even your husband. Maybe especially your husband. It takes a certain absence from touching to make you fully appreciate the geometry of the hug, the precise angle of your head in relation to his. Should it be roosted in under the neck, as pigeons do, or nose pressed to his chest? And your hands, cupped in the small of his back, or palms laid flat along the flanges of his thighs? When Richard and I met that lunchtime outside Starbucks, we both meant to deliver a peck on the cheek, but it felt too silly, the kind of kiss you could only give to an aunt, so we splayed awkwardly into the hug. I felt as gauche, as painfully observed, as when my dad first took me shuffling round the floor at a dinner dance. Richard's body shocked me by being a body, his hair and its smell, the bulk of shoulder under his jumper. The hug wasn't that dry click of bones you get holding someone when the passion has drained away. It was more like a shadow dance. I still wanted him, and I think he wanted me, but we hadn't touched in a very long time.
Hey, you're glowing, Rich says.
I've been ice skating.
Ice skating? On a work morning?
Sort of client liaison. A new approach. Rich and I have arranged a meeting to talk things over. We have seen each other almost every day since he left. As he promised, he has collected M from school and then often stayed to have tea with both children. Starbucks feels like the right sort of place to negotiate a peace, a modern no-man's land, one of those businesses which dresses itself up to look like the home we're all too busy to go to. It's surprisingly quiet in here, but the meeting has all the anxieties of a first date. Will he? Won't he? Only now they're attached to divorce. Won't he? Will he? We find a couple of big squashy velvet chairs in a corner, and Rich goes to get the drinks. I have requested a skinny latte. He comes back with the hot chocolate I want and need. The small talk feels unbearably small. I am impatient to get on to the big talk, so it can be over, one way or the other.
How's work, Kate?
Oh, fine. Actually, I may soon be leaving my job. Or rather, my job may soon be leaving me. Rich shakes his head and smiles.
They'd never fire you.
Oh, under certain circumstances they might. He gives me that man in the white coat look.
We're not talking about meaningless self-sacrifice, Mrs. Shattuck, are we, by any chance?
Why do you ask that?
Just that I'm old enough to remember your cyclists against the bomb phase.
I've given the firm everything, Rich. Time that belonged to you and the children.
And to you, Kate.
Once I could read his face like a book. Now the book has been translated into another language. I thought you'd approve, breaking away from the system. He looks younger since he left me. Your mother thinks I've let myself go.
My mother thinks Grace Kelly let herself go.
We both laugh, and for a moment Starbucks is filled with the sound of us. I start to tell Rich about the story Winston told me.
Who's Winston?
He's the one from Pegasus Cars, but it turns out he's a philosopher.
A philosopher driving a minicab? That sounds safe.
No, he's fantastic. Really, he is. Anyway, Winston told me the story about this general who found a tribe by a waterfall, and the head of the tribe...
Cicero.
No.
Cicero. It's by Cicero.
My husband breaks a chocolate cookie in half and hands one piece to me. Let me guess. Someone dead for a long time that I've never heard of because I went to a crap comprehensive, but who forms a vital part of every civilized person's education?
I love you.
So you see, I was thinking of moving away from the waterfall to see if I could hear better.
Kate?
He pushes his hand across the table so it's near mine. The hands lie next to each other, as if waiting for a child to draw around them. There's nothing left to love, Rich. I'm all hollowed out. Kate doesn't live here anymore. The hand is on mine now.
You were saying about moving away from the waterfall?
I thought if we moved away from the waterfall, we could hear again, and then we could decide if...
If it was the noise that stopped us hearing, or the fact that we didn't have anything to say to each other anymore?
Do you know those moments? The sheer merciful relief of there being someone in the world who knows what you're thinking as you think it. I nod my grateful acknowledgement. My name is Kate Reddy, and I am a workaholic. Isn't that what they have to say at those meetings?
I didn't say you were a workaholic.
Why not? It's true, isn't it? I can't give up work. That makes me an addict, doesn't it?
We need to buy ourselves some time, that's all.
Rich, do you remember when M tried to climb into the TV to save Sleeping Beauty? I keep thinking about it.
He grins.
One of the best things about having children is that it enables you to have the same loving memories as another person. You can summon the same past. Two flashbacks with but a single image. Is that as good as two hearts that beat as one?
Daft kid. She was so upset that she couldn't save that stupid princess, wasn't she? Rich says, with that exasperated pride M provokes in us.
She'd really like you to come home.
And you? How about you, Kate?
The option to say something proud and defiant hangs there waiting to be picked, like a ripe fruit. I leave it hanging and say, I'd like to come home, too. Sleeping Beauty was always Emily's favorite, the first video she really noticed. When she was 2 years old, she became obsessed with it, standing in front of the TV and shouting,
Wind it! Wind it!
She always shouted at the part where Aurora, with her stupefied doll face, makes her way up the long staircase to the attic, pursued by a raven shadow and a bad fairy cackle. For a long time, Richard and I couldn't work out what was making Emily so furious. Then it clicked. She wanted us to rewind the tape so that the princess wouldn't make it to the attic, so she never would prick her finger on the old woman's spindle. One day, Emily actually tried to climb inside the TV set. I found her standing on a chair attempting to insert her red-shoed foot through the screen. I believe she had plans to grab the hapless princess and stop her from meeting her fate. We had a long talk, well, I talked and she listened, about how you had to let things like that happen, because even when you got to a scary bit, the story knew where it was heading, and it couldn't be stopped, no matter how much you wanted it to be. And the good thing was, you knew it would turn out happily in the end. But she shook her head sadly and said,
"No, wind it, Mummy, wind it."
Soon after, my daughter transferred her allegiance to Barney the Dinosaur, whose great adventure featured no deeds of darkness that required her personal intervention. Adults want to rewind life too. It's just that along the way we lose the capacity to shout it out loud. Wind it. Wind it. Chapter 39. Endgame. An article from the November issue of Inside Finance. Edwin Morgan Forster, one of the city's oldest financial institutions, triumphed at the 5th annual Equality Now Awards on Tuesday night, winning the category for Most Improved Company for its commitment to diversity. The firm scored highly in an annual benchmarking survey conducted by Equality Yes, an organization committed to gender parity whose members include 81% of the FTSE 100 companies. The judges were particularly impressed by the volume of business generated by Catherine Reddy, EMF's youngest female manager, and Momo Gumaratne, a 24-year-old Sri Lankan graduate of the London School of Economics. Unfortunately, the two women were unable to attend the ceremony, but the award was collected by Rod Task, EMF head of marketing. In his acceptance speech, Task said, "There is a good deal of evidence that mixed gender teams are critical to effective team functioning. EMF is at the forefront of bringing women into major roles in the financial community." Striking a less positive note on the evening was Catherine Mulroyd, chair of Women Mean Business. "These awards are not telling the whole story," said Mulroyd. "It's hard enough to reach a position of real influence as a woman in the square mile without wrecking your career by opening your mouth to criticize the culture. Equality for women remains a marginal issue for most city firms. It seems pointless for banks to spend vast sums on training female recruits, only to lose them because they do not have flex time or any of the things that could keep mothers on board." Asked if the old boy culture was a thing of the past, Task pointed out that he was from Australia and was therefore very much part of the new boy network. "The girls have done just great this year, and I'm proud of them." My father gave the performance of his life during the presentation to Chris Bunce of the biodegradable nappy. Deborah, who was present throughout in her capacity as legal advisor, told me that Dad was not only sober, but clearly relished the part of maverick inventor. "His masterstroke," Deb said, "came when Bunce offered to write a check there and then, and Joe, who had spent a lifetime trying to wheedle checks out of people, said that he and his lawyer would be meeting a number of interested parties over the coming days, but naturally they would keep EMF informed. I had explained to Dad that I thought I had found some venture capital for his invention, but it would require him to pretend to be someone else and to tell some minor untruths. In almost any other father-daughter relationship, this would have been a bizarre exchange, but for us it felt like the natural culmination of years of pretense, an acknowledgement that forgery is woven into the ready DNA along with blue eyes and a facility with numbers."
"He's a brilliant guy, your dad," said Winston,
who acted as chauffeur for the nappy entrepreneur, in a black BMW with tinted windows that he had borrowed from a man he described as his uncle.
"Joe's a really great tipper."
"Yes, with my money." 3 days later, Bunce signed over the cash. Swaggering in from lunch that afternoon, he told his deputy, Veronica Pick, that she should pay attention to his amazing coup, This was where men scored over women, acting decisively, scenting a great opportunity and not getting bogged down in the fine print.
"Oh, you did your due diligence, did you?" asked Veronica sweetly.
"What do you mean?" said Bunce.
"Due diligence," said Veronica. "Checking the director's credentials are what they say they are, sussing out plant and production viability, veracity of bank references. But I'm sure I don't need to tell you about any of that."
"If I need your advice, I'll ask for it," said Bunce.
Nor could he resist gloating to me the next morning as we gathered in the conference room, one hand massaging his manhood as though it were Aladdin's lamp.
"Found this brilliant new nappy product, Kate. Gonna make us a shitload of money. Get it? Shitload? Just your kind of thing, Mum. Pity I got there first."
I bestowed upon him my most maternal smile. The money Bunce invested was enough to cover the business's debts and therefore to pay off my father's creditors. No sooner had it landed in J.R. Power's account than it was gone. As I had predicted, neither that nor Momo's formal complaint of sexual harassment was quite sufficient to sink Bunce for good at EMF. That was taken care of a few days later, when an interview that Edwin Morgan Forster's head of venture capital had given to the investigative TV journalist Alice Lloyd appeared in a national tabloid newspaper under the headline, "Porn Again, How City's Mr. Big Keeps It Up." Alice had taken Bunce to a favorite media haunt in Soho. After ingesting quantities of drugs, legal and illegal, he became very forthcoming, and the sighting of a young soap star across the room sent him over the edge.
"I'd like to have her on my website," he told Alice. "Actually, I'd like to have her anywhere she likes it."
Boasting about his ability to pick winners, Bunce cited a recent investment in a certain biodegradable nappy, which he reckoned was gonna be bigger than fucking Viagra. The city can always act to neutralize bad smells within the square mile, but when the stench reaches beyond, to the sensitive nostrils of clients and opinion formers, retribution is swift and merciless. The morning after the article appeared, Candy and I stood and watched as Chris Bunce was called into Robin Cooper Clark's office, escorted by two security guards to his desk, which he was given 3 minutes to clear, and then finally marched out of the building.
"Anybody got that Falconer's number?" shouted Candy. "There's a rat in the street."
In the ladies' washroom, a few minutes later, I found Momo Gumaratni crying, her face buried in the roller towel.
"Happy crying," she insisted between hiccups.
"And me?" I was glad he was gone, of course. But without noticing it, I had started to find Bunce more sad than bad. At lunchtime, Momo and I took a cab to Bond Street. I told her it was important work-related business, which it was. My assistant was puzzled.
"What are we doing in a shoe shop, Kate?"
"Well, we're looking for a glass slipper that can take the highest possible pressure per square millimetre and doesn't fall off at midnight. Failing that, we'll take these. And these. Oh, and those brown boots are great. Excuse me, do you have these in a 4?
"Are your feet size 4?
Asks Momo dubiously.
"No, yours are."
"But I can't possibly."
20 minutes later, we were standing at the cash desk with 4 boxes. Faced with the choice between the tan kitten heels and the navy slingbacks, we chose both. And then we took the black stilettos because they were too beautiful not to own, and the toffee boots, which were a total bargain.
"I love the black ones," she says, "but I can't actually walk in them."
"Walking isn't really the point, Momo. Walking tall is the point. And if the worst comes to the worst, you can always use one of the heels to puncture Guy's carotid artery." The smile vanishes.
"Where will you be?"
"I'm going away for a while."
"No," she says. "I don't want a goodbye present."
"You're going to be fine."
"How do you know?"
"Hey, who trained you?"
"Anyway, you've stopped saying sorry, so I know you're ready."
"No,"
says Momo, and she looks at me sideways.
"Only one of us can ever be ready, Kate."
Then she puts a hand on my shoulder and kisses me on the cheek. On the way back in the taxi, a mountain range of shoes at our feet, she asked me why I was leaving, and I lied. Told her I needed to move to be nearer my mother, who was ill. Some things you can't say, even to the women you love. Even to yourself. Reasons to give up work. 1. Because I have got 2 lives, and I don't have time to enjoy either of them. 2. Because 24 hours are not enough. 3. Because my children will be young for only a short time. 4. Because one day I caught my husband looking at me the way my mother used to look at my father. 5. Because becoming a man is the waste of a woman. 6. Because I am too tired to think of another because. The next day, before I resigned, I had a bit of tidying up to do. The pigeon family was long gone. The 2 chicks finally flew the nest when spring was easing into summer. But the books that had hidden mother and babies from the city hawk were still in place. This time I didn't risk the ledge. I called Gerald up from security to give me a hand forcing open the window. The books had all survived quite well, except the 10 natural laws of successful time and life management, proven strategies for increased productivity and inner peace. It looked like the floor of a cave, with little stalagmites of white pigeon shit obscuring its uplifting cover slogans. When I went into Rod's office, I found him sitting at his desk behind the Equality Now trophy, a set of scales with a tiny bronze figure of a female in one of the pans. In the other, Rod had put a handful of jelly beans. He took the news of my leaving pretty badly. So badly, in fact, that the noise travelled through the wall to Robin Cooper Clark next door.
"Katie's doing a runner," Rod announced, as the head of investment put his head round the door to establish the source of the roar.
Robin called me into his office, as I knew he would.
"Is there anything I can do to persuade you to change your mind, Kate?"
"Only changing your world," I thought.
"No, really."
"Maybe part-time," he ventures, with that ghost of a smile. "I've seen what happens when a woman tries to go part-time, Robin. They say she's having her days off, and then they cut her out of the loop, and then they take her funds away from her one by one, because everyone knows that managing money's a full-time job."
"It is hard to manage money less than 5 days a week."
I don't say anything. He tries another tack.
"If it's a question of money..."
"No, it's time."
"Ah, sed fugit in terrea, fugit irreparabili tempus."
"If that means you shouldn't waste 30 years staring at a screen, then yes." Robin comes round to my side of the desk and stands there with that awkwardness they call dignity.
"I'm going to miss you, Kate."
By way of reply, I give him a hug. Perhaps the first ever administered in the offices of Edwin Morgan Forster. Then I go home, taking care to run across the grass. Chapter 40. The Court of Motherhood. She was not afraid of the court any more. They had nothing left to throw at her. Nothing they could charge her with that she hadn't accused herself of 1,000 times. So there she was, feeling quietly confident. And then they said the name of the next witness, and suddenly she knew it was all over. Her time was up. As she swayed forward, feeling slightly sick, her hands clutched the oak rim of the dock. Here was the one person in the world who knew her best.
"The court calls Mrs. Jean Reddy."
The defendant was upset at the sight of her mother entering the witness box to give evidence against her, but there was something about the older woman's appearance that she found oddly cheering. It took her a few seconds to place it. Mum was wearing red cashmere, the cardigan Kate had given her for Christmas, over the Liberty's floral blouse she had bought her for the birthday before last. The things kept for best were getting their first outing.
"State your full name, please."
"Jean Catherine Reddy."
"And your relation to the defendant?"
Catherine's my daughter. I'm her mother."
The prosecuting counsel is not just on his feet.
he is standing on tiptoes with excitement.
Mrs. Reddy, your daughter is accused of putting her job before the welfare of her children. Is that an accurate description of the situation you have observed firsthand?
No.
Speak up, please,
bellows the judge. Mum tries again. Clearly nervous, she is tugging on her charm bracelet.
No. Catherine is devoted to her children, and she is very hard-working, always has been, keen to get on and better herself.
Yes, yes, snaps the prosecution. But do I understand she is not presently living with her husband, Richard Shattuck, who left her after he said that she had ceased to notice he was there?
The woman in the dock makes a low, moaning sound. Her mother doesn't know that Richard has left her. Jean Reddy takes the news like a boxer taking a blow and fires back magnificently.
No one's saying it's easy. Men want looking after, and it's hard for a woman when she's got her work as well. Kath's got that many calls on her time. I've seen her make herself ill with it sometimes.
Mrs. Reddy, are you familiar with the name Jack Abelhammer?
Says the prosecution, with a quick, tight smile.
No, no!
The defendant has climbed over the side of the dock and is standing in front of the judge in an XXL Gap T-shirt with a dachshund motif.
All right, what do you want me to say? Guilty? Is that what you want me to say? There really are no lengths you won't go to prove I can't live my life, are there?
Silence, booms the judge. Mrs. Shattuck, one more interruption, and I will find you in contempt of court.
Well, that's fine, because I am in utter contempt of this court and every man in it.
And then she starts to cry, cursing herself as she does so for her weakness.
Jean Reddy,
resumes the prosecution, but the witness is not listening to him. She too has left her place and moves towards the weeping woman, whom she gathers in her arms. And then the mother turns on the judge.
And how about you, Your Honour? Who'll be getting your tea tonight? It's not you, is it?
For God's sake, splutters the judge.
People like you don't understand anything about women like Catherine, and you think you can sit in judgment on her. Shame on you,
says Jean Reddy quietly, but with the force that generations of children heard in her voice when she was rebuking a playground bully. On the day that Seymour Troy Stratton entered the world, a coup in Qatar sent oil prices spiraling and equities plunged around the globe, helped by an unprecedented rate hike from the mighty Federal Reserve. In the UK alone, $20 billion was wiped off the value of the FTSE 100. A minor earthquake outside Kyoto caused further shockwaves in an already shaken global environment. None of this had an adverse effect on mother and baby, who dozed peacefully in their curtained cubicle on the third floor of the maternity wing off Gower Street. As I walk down the corridor towards them, I am returned powerfully to my memories of this place. The midwives in their blue pyjamas, the grey doors behind which the great first act of life is performed over and over by small women and tall women, and a woman whose waters broke one lunchtime on the escalator at bank. Place of pain and elation, flesh and blood. The cries of the babies raw and astounded, their mothers' faces salty with joy. When you are in here, you think you know what's important. And you are right. It's not the pethidine talking. It's God's own truth. Before long, you have to go out into the world again and pretend you have forgotten, pretend there are better things to do. But there are no better things. Every mother knows what it felt like when that chamber of the heart opened and love flooded in. Everything else is just noise and men.
I just want to look at him, Candy says.
Propped up on pillows, my colleague has undone every button on my white broderie anglaise nightdress to give her son access to her breasts. The nipples are like dark fruit. She uses the palm of her right hand to cup his head while his mouth sucks hungrily.
I don't want to do anything except look at him, Kate. That's normal, right?
Perfectly normal. I have brought a Paddington Bear rattle for the baby, the one with the red hat that Emily always loved, and a basket of American muffins for his mom. Candy says she needs to get the weight off right away, and then, because her hands are full, I feed morsel after morsel into her unprotesting mouth. The baby will suck all the fat out of your saddlebags, Cand.
Hey, that's terrific. How long can I keep nursing? 20 years?
Unfortunately, after a while, they come round and arrest you. I sometimes think they'd send the social services in if they knew how passionately I feel about Ben.
You didn't tell me, she rebukes me with a tired smile.
I did try. That day in Corny and Barrow. But you can't know until you know. Candy lowers her face and smells the head of her son.
A boy, Kate. I made one. How cool is that?
Like all newborn things, Seymour Stratton seems ancient, 1,000 years old. His brow is corrugated with either wisdom or perplexity. It is not yet possible to speculate on what manner of man he will grow up to be, but for now he is perfectly happy as he is, in the encircling arms of a woman. Epilogue. What Kate did next. I think an ending may be out of the question. The wheels on the bus go round and round all day long. A lot happened, though, and some things stayed the same. 3 months after Seymour's birth, Candy went back to work at EMF and put the baby into a daycare place near Liverpool Street that charged more than the Dorchester. Candy reckoned each diaper change cost her $20.
That's a hell of a lot for a dump, right?
On the phone, she sounded like the same old Candy, but I knew that that Candy, the Candy before children, had gone. Sure enough, the long, brutal hours she had worked uncomplainingly all her adult life soon seemed to her stupid and unnecessary. She minded that when she tried to leave at 6:30, Rod Task called it lunchtime. She minded not seeing her son in daylight. When Seymour was 7 months old, Candy walked into Rod's office and told him she was very sorry, but she was going to have to let him go. She was having some problems with his level of commitment. It was too high. Back in New Jersey, she stayed for a while with her mom until she found a place of her own. Candy said Seymour had made her understand what her mother was for. Soon after, she spotted a hole in the booming mail order market and established a business which in a short time saw her tipped as one of Fortune magazine's faces to watch. All Work and No Play was a range of sex toys for the female executive who has everything except time for pleasure. A box of samples was shipped to me in England, and it was opened on our breakfast table during a visit from Barbara and Donald. Richard, in what many consider to be the finest half hour of our marriage, pretended the vibrators were a range of kitchen utensils. My beloved Momo stayed on at EMF, where she flew up the ladder, barely touching the rungs. That touch of steel in her nature I had noticed at our first meeting proved invaluable, as did her ability to listen and absorb what clients wanted. Occasionally she would call me for advice in the middle of the day from the ladies' washroom, her whispers half drowned by flushing. In the summer she snatched a couple of days off and came up to stay with us. For the first time in her life, Emily was impressed with me. At long last, her mother had produced a real princess.
"Are you Princess Jasmine from Aladdin?"
Em asked.
"Actually, more Sleeping Beauty," Momo said. "I was sort of asleep, and then your mummy woke me up."
Deborah discovered that Jim was having an affair with a woman in Hong Kong. They got divorced, and Deb arranged to work a 4-day week at her law firm. Soon she found some of her biggest clients were taken away from her, but she let it pass. The time for fighting back, she told herself, would come when Felix and Ruby were older. Deb and I are planning a weekend break together at a spa, and so far we have cancelled only 4 times. Winston went on to take his degree in philosophy at the University of East London, and his ethics dissertation, How Do We Know What Is Right, achieved the highest mark in the year. To pay his final year fees, he sold Pegasus, which seamlessly entered a new career in stock car racing. flourishing a guilty and therefore glowing reference from me, Paula landed a job as nanny to the B-movie action star Adolf Brock and his wife, a former Miss Bulgaria. The family lived for a while at the Plaza in New York until Paula, whose room overlooked Central Park, announced that she was feeling cramped, whereupon the Brocks moved obediently to Maine. After that morning on the ice rink, I never saw Jack Abelhammer again. I changed my email address because I knew that my willpower was not strong enough to stop me returning a message from him. I also knew that my marriage would only have a fighting chance if I let go of my fantasy lover. If Jack was the place I went to play, what did that make Richard? Even so, every time I log on, part of me still expects to see his name in the inbox. People say that time is a great healer. Which people? What are they talking about? I think some feelings you experience in your life are written in indelible ink, and the best you can hope for is that they fade a little over the years. I never went to bed with Jack. I regret the size of a continent, but the bad food and the great songs in the Sinatra Inn were the best sex I never had. When you felt that much about a man and he disappears from your life, after a while you start to think it was just some foolish illusion on your part and that the other person walked clean away, no scar tissue. But maybe the other person felt the same. I still have the last message he sent me. To Kate Reddy, from Jack Abelhammer.
Kate, I didn't hear from you in quite a while, so I'm working on the theory that you took up Conkers and motherhood full-time. But I know you'll be back. Hail the conquering heroine. Rod said you left London. Remember what your dad called Sinatra? The patron saint of unrequited love. The great thing about unrequited love is it's the only kind that lasts. Yours forever, Jack.
Richard and I sold the Hackney Heap, moved up to Derbyshire near my family, and bought a place on the edge of a market town with a view and a paddock. I'd always wanted a paddock, and now I had one, I had no idea what to do with it. The house needs loads of work, but there are a couple of good rooms, and the rest can wait. The kids love having the space to run around in, and Richard is in his element. When he's not working on the art center, he's building a dry stone wall, and every 5 minutes he asks me to come and look at it. Not long after I resigned, I got a call from Robin Cooper Clark, asking if I'd come in with him on a hedge fund. Part-time work, minimal foreign travel, all promises that I knew would be scorched away in the heat of the chase. It was tempting. With the money he was offering, I could have bought half the village, and things are pretty tight for us with just the one income. But when Emily heard me say Robin's name, she stiffened and said,
"Please don't talk to him."
Cooper Clark is a name she associates with the years Mummy went missing. I know my daughter a little better these days. A couple of months after leaving work, I realized that all those carefully timetabled bedtime chats had told me nothing about what was really going on in Em's head. That stuff comes out spontaneously. You can't force it. You just have to be around when it happens. As for her brother, his sweetness grows in direct proportion to his capacity for mischief. Recently he discovered Lego, with which he builds a wall, and every 5 minutes he asks me to come and look at it. Richard and I took both kids down to meet Sally Cooper Clark. She was as kind and warm as Robin had described, and I could see how she gave him back his ease and elasticity, not to mention his immaculate shirts. On the drive back, I left Rich and the kids in a pub garden for 10 minutes, and I walked across to the church and down the hill to Jill Cooper Clark's grave. Weird, isn't it, how you want to seek out the physical place where someone is buried? If Jill is anywhere now, she's everywhere. But I stood there anyway, in front of the neat white headstone with the soft grey lettering. At the bottom it says, "She was well loved." I didn't actually speak aloud. This was Sussex, for heaven's sake. But I thought all the things that I wanted Jill to know about. They say that women need role models, and I suppose we do. But high achievement is not confined to high flyers. There is a currency we were never called upon to trade in at EMF, and in that Jill was the richest person I've ever met. And me? Whatever happened to me? Well, I spent some time with myself, a pretty unsatisfactory companion. I loved walking Emily to the local school and standing at the gate to collect her. The puddles are iced over this time of year, and we love to stand on them and wait for the creak before the crack. During school time, Ben and I pottered around the house and hung out at coffee mornings with other mums with small kids. I was bored to the point of manslaughter. My eczema cleared up, but my cheeks ached from trying to keep my face looking friendly and interested. Queuing in the local bank, I would find myself sneaking looks at the foreign exchange rates. I have an awful feeling they thought I was planning a robbery. Then, a couple of Fridays ago, I got a call from Julie. It was a crackly mobile, but I could tell she was in tears. For a second I thought, Mum, and my stomach went down a mineshaft. But it wasn't that. The factory where Jules does piecework had gone bust. Manager done a bunk. Receivers called in. They were putting padlocks on the doors. All the women who had still been at their machines were now shivering out in the yard. Could I come down? No, I said. Ben needed his lunch, and besides, I really didn't know what use I could be. When Julie answered, it was in a voice I recognized from childhood, the one my little sister had when she asked if she could get into bed with me as the raging voices of our mother and father came through the floorboards. But I've told everyone you're a businesswoman, Kath, and you'll be able to tell us what's what. Combed my hair, put some lipstick on, and dug out Armani jacket from the wardrobe in the spare room. I wanted to look like the woman Julie had described to her colleagues. When I slipped the jacket on, it was like being back in uniform, the grey wool impregnated with the smell of power, of money being made and things getting done. I wrestled Ben into the baby seat and drove down to the industrial estate. It wasn't hard to find Julie's place. The notice on the fence said, "Traditional English Dolls Houses," and over that was a sticker, "Liquidation Sale. Everything must go." In the yard there were about 40 seamstresses, many wearing the most amazing saris. They parted as I arrived, and it was like walking through a flock of tropical birds. I waved my old platinum Amex at the guy standing by a side door, told him I'd come up from London and was looking to buy some stuff. Inside, the dollhouses were abandoned in mid-decoration. Tiny sofas, footstools, velvet pelmets, porcelain toilets awaiting their wooden seats, grand pianos the size of a powder compact. "What can we do, Kath?" asked Julie when I came out. "Absolutely nothing. I'll try and find out what's happened." The next day, I dropped Em at school, left a delighted Ben with his equally delighted grandmother, and got the train down to London. Cab across town to company's house. It didn't take long to get the dollhouse people's accounts for the last 5 years. You should have seen them. The business was a wreck. Disappearing margins, no investment, piles of debt, a complete financial basket case. On the train back up north, I tried to read the paper, but the type wouldn't stay still. There were plenty of ethical funds out there under instruction to invest in women-only companies. I knew that better than anyone. Money for the taking, really. But when the train shuddered to a halt at Chesterfield, it shook some sense into me. "Kate Reddy, I can't believe you are even having this thought. Take on something like that. You'd have to be out of your mind, woman. Out of your bloody mind." 7:37 p.m. Bedtime. Brush teeth, 4 recitations of Goodnight Moon, 3 Owl Babies, visits to the bathroom, 4, attempts on potty, 2, time taken till lights out, 48 minutes. Must improve. 8:37 p.m. Call to Candy Stratton in New Jersey to discuss mail order market and distribution with view to global dollhouse business.
"I knew it," she hollers.
"I'm making inquiries for a friend."
"Yeah, right. Tell her to wear that red bra when she goes to get the financing."
9:11 p.m. Call to Jerry at Dickinson Bishop in New York. Sussing out funds specifically designated to invest in women-only companies. Jerry says it's a steal.
Ethical's the new Viagra, Katie.
10:27 p.m. Ben has accident in bed. Change sheet. Try to find pull-up nappy. Where are nappies? 11:48 p.m. Wake Momo Gumarantney at home to talk about possibility of wooden dollhouse frames being made by workers employed by Sri Lankan aid agency she's been advising.
Kate, she says, can I do it with you?
I'm not doing anything. Go back to sleep. Midnight. Take glass of water up to Emily. The great grey eyes stare up at me in the dark.
Mummy, you're thinking,
she says accusingly. Yes, love. It's allowed, you know. How would you like to help Mummy build a palace?
Yes, but it's got to have a towel where Beauty sleeps.
It absolutely does. 1:01 a.m. Still time to go over the figures from the factory. What is required is a proper marketing plan and some diversification. How about a range of buildings instead of the traditional Georgian townhouse? A New York brownstone, maybe. A cottage. Offices. Castles. Ships. Emily's palace. Richard could design them. 1:37 a.m.
Kate, what do you think you're doing? It's 2 o'clock in the morning.
My husband, Richard, is standing in the doorway of the kitchen. Rich, with his acres of English reasonableness and his invincible kindness.
Darling, he says, it's so late.
I'm just coming.
What is it?
Nothing. He squints curiously at me in the light.
What kind of nothing?
Oh, I was just thinking about, you know, homemaking. He raises an eyebrow. Don't worry. Warm my side of the bed. I'm just coming.
The kiss he plants on my forehead is a question as much as a gift.
Seeing my husband go upstairs, I long to follow him, but I can't leave the kitchen in this state. I just can't. The room bears signs of heavy fighting. There is Lego shrapnel over a wide area. In my absence, 3 apples and 4 satsumas have been added to the big glass bowl, but no one has thought to discard the old fruit beneath, and the pears at the bottom have started weeping a sticky amber resin. As I throw each pear in the bin, I worry about the cost. After washing and drying the bowl, I carefully wipe any stray amber goo off the apples and put them back. All I need to do now is get Emily's lunchbox ready for the morning, check the time for Ben's appointment at the surgery, see if I can get from there to the bank to talk to my manager, convene a meeting of workers at the factory, call the receivers and still get back in time for school pickup. Chicken out of freezer. Chicken out of PTA meeting. Emily wants horse. Over my dead body. Who will end up cleaning out the stable? Rich's birthday. Surprise dinner? Bread, milk, honey. And there was something else. I know there was something else. What else? This concludes the reading of I Don't Know How She Does It by Alison Pearson. Copyright 2002 by Alison Pearson. This full-length reading was published by arrangement with Random House Audio Publishing Group, a division of Random House, Incorporated, and was produced in 2002 by Books on Tape, Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. This book was read by Josephine Bailey.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.